Now, a recent survey of 2,000 people found that Americans can't go a day without uttering or yelling a swear word. In fact, many Americans swear before 11 in the morning, on average. The survey, while maybe not the most scientific, illuminated the fact that people have a special relationship with profanity. Whether you do swear or not, the use of profanity is woven into most, if not all, the languages on our planet. And for years, swearing was seen as coarse or an example of a stunted vocabulary. But some new research shows that swearing tells us a lot about what's going on in our brains, might even, in some cases, be good for us. Emma Byrne is a science writer and the author of Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. Emma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, good evening, Rob.
What took you down this path of studying our swearing habits, Emma?
See, that was the odd thing, because my background's actually in artificial intelligence, but I was working in a computational neuroscience lab, which is where we try to build models of the brain, and I was really interested in our relationship with pain. And I came across the study that is kind of the thing that triggered my whole interest in swearing, that showed that if you're sticking your hand in ice-cold water, then swearing lets you keep your hand in there about half as long again than if you're not. And that regardless of how much you swear in your everyday life, or regardless of how much you say you like or dislike swearing, there is this really strong analgesic effect to swearing. And it just seems so paradoxical to me. It's something that's so good for us, is something that we spend so long trying to tell ourselves, and particularly tell our children, that we ought not to be doing.
And swearing, so it has this pain-relieving angle to it. What's going on in our brains to make that happen?
And that's a really fascinating question. We're only just starting to unpick it. We know it's probably something to do with the emotional response that happens when you swear. So we can measure that physiologically. We don't just ask people how they feel when they hear swearing, because when you ask people about their emotions, they tend to give answers that are a little bit misleading. We sometimes don't know what our own emotional state is. So instead, we do things like measure their heart rate, or something called the galvanic skin response, how sweaty your palms are getting, for example. And that'll tell you how, you know, what is called arousal technically, but just how strong your emotional state is. And we know that when people hear or use swearing, that their emotional state tends to intensify, but we don't quite know what emotional state it is that's so important to withstanding pain. There's lots of really interesting and conflicting research, some that say it might be aggression, some that say it's anger, some that say it's something to do with the fight or flight response. But there is something about swearing that intensifies our feelings to such an extent that pain just isn't as strong.
I want to stay in the brain for a moment before we move out of it. I'd never seen this before. There's research out there looking at people who have lost some language parts of their brain and yet kept their ability to swear. So swearing is sometimes different in our brain than the rest of our speech?
Absolutely, particularly something that's called non-propositional swearing. So the swearing that, you know, someone cuts you off when you're driving, or you drop something heavy on your foot, it's exasperation or pain or surprise. I won't repeat, because we're on the air, the thing that I said the other day when I saw someone do a very bad maneuver on the motorway, the highway here, but it was just purely without any kind of conscious planning to say this phrase in front of my husband and my friend and the two children in the back seat. And that kind of swearing comes from a very different set of neurological architecture than the swearing that, you know, we use in a more propositional way, in a way that we use deliberately to make a certain point. So when you see people who've had strokes that have damaged the left side of the brain, that have catastrophically undermined people's ability to use language, they can still swear and do still swear in a way that is emotionally truthful, that is a way of expressing their feelings about something, positive as well as negative, even though the rest of the language is gone.
Talking to Emma Byrne, her new book is Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. Emma, you don't just write about the science of swearing, but also kind of the culture and social aspects of it. We heard on Facebook from a lot of people, actually. Tim on Facebook says that looking down on swearing is a way we reinforce class. So there's this class element that, and at different points in history, the idea that swearing is for what, the lower orders or something like that.
That's absolutely right. And here in the UK, there's a sort of odd relationship with swearing in class, in that it's seen as, certain swear words anyway, are seen as being quite a working class thing. They're a sign of being quite strong and tough and not really caring much for authority. But then when you reach the absolute upper echelons, I mean, literally royalty, your ability to get away with swearing because you know that you're not going to be judged for it suddenly means that you can say whatever the heck you like. In fact, quite famously, one of our kings on his deathbed is alleged to have said bugger Bognor, which is now not so much of a swear word. But at the time, you know, he was replying to the royal physician who said, you know, you should probably go to the sea side and take some air to try to improve your health. And his final, famously, his dying words had a swear word in them. But when you're royal, you can get away with it. And there's this sort of squeezed middle, particularly here in the UK, where we're trying to appear educated, we're trying to appear cultured and refined. And so we don't use this language because it has this, I don't know, kind of reputation as being base and animalistic. Partly, I think, because we do use it in this non-propositional way. But actually, those people who do use it creatively have also been shown to have the widest and most creative vocabularies in general. It's not actually a sign of a stunted vocabulary, despite what your parents might have told you.
Now, that's upper and lower class. You also write about a whole chapter, actually, about men and women and swearing. And I love this, going back to 1673, a chaplain to another English king writes that swearing makes women affectedly masculine. It turns them into men. And here's a quote: "There is no noise on this side of hell that can be more amazingly odious than an oath out of a woman's mouth." Wow.
I know. He's never heard me singing. But yeah, I mean, it's astounding, isn't it? You know, in a time when people still have memories of the plague, when people had incurable illnesses, where there was poverty and the sound of hungry children. No, it was a woman saying a rude word. It was the worst thing you could possibly hear. And interestingly, until that point, there were men and women who were famous for their ability with bad language and insults, and kind of like rappers today. There was a whole branch of the entertainment industry that was about being the most creative swearer and insulter, and men and women were celebrated for it, until this guy and his ilk came along saying that, you know, women ought to try to preserve this idea of modesty and innocence. And that really lingers with us. There's a study from about 10 years ago now that showed that if you randomize whether or not you say swearing comes from a man or a woman, people will automatically judge it as being more offensive if they're told it's a woman saying it.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if this is the same study you write that, okay, people put all these words out and say, is this a word that men say or women say? F word, some other swear words, yeah, men. Not a single swear word was linked with a women's language.
That's right. That's actually corpus studies. So you look at how people are using language. And while women do use as much swearing in quantity, or certainly in the UK, as men, we tend to use much milder words, things that are not considered to be strong swear words, whereas men tend, particularly in British English, to just use the F word a lot. And so it is in something like the top 10 or 15 of significantly male words where there is a significant difference between how often they're used by men and how often they're used by women. So this idea of kind of casual social swearing being more of a masculine thing is certainly borne out by the research. But it's not that women don't swear, it's just that we have to be much more judicious about who we swear in front of and when we use it.
We're talking to Emma Byrne right now. She's a science writer and author of Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. You can join in with your PG or under language at 800-642-1234. What do you think of swearing? Do you do it? Does it bother you when other people do it? Or is it all situational, where you are, who you're with? Do you think that it helps you out in some ways? Do you feel that pain relief when you hurt yourself and swear, maybe without even effort to say those words? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Also a conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up this conversation coming up on Central Time.
We gotta clear the snakes out of the carpet.
Yeah, clear the snakes out of the carpet, yeah.
Enough is enough! I have had it with these monkey-fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane! Everybody strap in!
About to open some freaking windows.
That's Samuel L. Jackson in the 2006 classic Snakes on a Plane. as edited for TV. He's clearly swearing, but not there. We're continuing our conversation about swearing and why it can sometimes be good for you. Emma Byrne is with us. She's the author of Swearing Is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Are swear words part of your vocabulary? When and where do you think they're okay and not okay? Do you feel bad about swearing when you do it? Or do you think it's a valid part of our human language? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Marsha on the Ideas Network Facebook page, Emma. She says she swears in English and other languages too, which increases her enjoyment. That makes me wonder, does every language have this set of forbidden, semi-forbidden words that are used creatively?
It seems so, yeah. I mean, there is a kind of a myth that there are some languages that have less swearing. Japanese is often cited, but it's just that taboos vary so much from language to language. So there isn't the same excretory taboo in Japanese, which is why we have the poop emoji in the emoji set on your mobile phone. It's because when emojis were developed in Japan, poo just isn't that much of a taboo. And so having that range, having that ability to swear in so many different languages, particularly if you've learnt them before adolescence, means that you have a whole, you know, a greater range of nuance, a greater range of taboos or situations that you can draw on and find something that's absolutely apt for the exact amount of frustration or elation that you're feeling at that time. I'm actually quite envious of people who have a really good secondary swearing vocabulary.
One anecdote I loved in your book, we can tell who's winning. This is a soccer game, football game in England. We can tell who's winning by listening to the fans and comparing the ratio of F words to S words as spoken by the fans. What?
That's right. So we did a corpus analysis. This is where you take language as it's really used and just look at the statistics of it. And Twitter is fantastic for this. People make their language available for you to look at. I mean, obviously, it's not reflective of language as we speak it, but it is a means of self-expression. And we found that for soccer fans, who are predominantly male as well in this country, that it is a way of showing solidarity and of sharing strong emotions, whether they're positive or negative, but that the F word can be used to intensify both kinds of emotions. So F yeah, that was a brilliant goal, or F no, I'm going home, this match is appalling. Whereas if they're using the S word, that's almost universally negative. We also found, interestingly, you would have expected that, particularly from the safety of their keyboard, that these football fans would be swearing about their opponents, that they'd be insulting the other team. But actually what really goes on is that they're insulting their own team. They're talking about the appalling playing of their own players, the players in the teams that they support. And it is a way for guys to show that they are experiencing sympathy with other men. So rather than saying, oh, there, this is a very disappointing game, isn't it? You get the string of profanity. But actually, when you talk to sociologists about this and what they're really doing, something called pragmatics in language, is they're demonstrating solidarity, they're demonstrating sympathy, they're not actually being utterly vile to one another. So while it might look like just a string of offensive words, there's actually quite a sweet bonding thing going on when they're swearing.
We're talking to Emma Byrne, author of Swearing Is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. You can join in with your thoughts on bad language, on swearing, how it fits into your life or does not at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also on Facebook, Daniel says he's made a commitment to try to cut down on his swearing. It's a normal part of his speech, except magically around his parents. He says, quote, even though I'm 41 years of age, I'm still swearing hundreds of times a day, but it's a work in progress. And people wrestle with this. I've been at this point in my life, and obviously with my job, I have a stretch of time where I can't swear at all. That's well beaten into me here. But I've tried to dial back at various points in my life. Is it, if we feel like we're doing it too much, Emma, is it worth trying to dial back our swearing?
Well, the original pain study seemed to show that if you swore a lot in your everyday life, that possibly it had less of an effect at killing pain. But actually, follow-ups have shown that there isn't a kind of a wearing off of its efficacy, that if you swear a lot in your everyday life, it's still just as effective at killing pain. But the one thing that it might do is sort of socially, kind of like antibiotic resistance, that as certain words lose their taboo, lose their ability to cause that real physiological emotional response, we start to have to reach for other stronger words. And so dialing it back a bit so that you're reserving them for the occasions when you really need them helps to preserve the kind of social potency, even if it isn't preserving that painkilling potency.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Bill on the line in Eau Claire. Bill, hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead. What did you want to tell us about, Bill?
Oh, I've got a wife, and we've been married, 60-some years, so... And I've heard her swear one time in her life.
Wow. And I imagine you knew she meant it in that one instance?
Well, I'll tell you, that's the instant that she used it. Here's the thing. She's been trying to get me to quit swearing. And I grew up in inner city Detroit. Then I was in a factory. Then I got drafted. And, I got drafted, and they made a Russian linguist out of me, and the Russians probably swear more than any group of people in the world.
True.
And I was swearing, and she didn't like it. I mean, she really didn't like it at all. And she won't even say darn because she thinks it's a contraction of damn. You know, and that's, to her, that's swearing. And so she's trying to get rid of it. A lot worse than that, you know. And one day we were sitting at the dinner table. It was on a Sunday, too, by the way. And all my five children, they're all sitting there. And she's on one end, and I'm on the other end. And all of a sudden she says, hey, Bill. And I said, sure, what do you need, honey? And she says, pass the half butter. Man, what, you know, I said, you know, and the kids just, you know, same time as I did, they said, Mom! And they'd never heard her swear.
Wow. Bill, thank you so much for sharing that story. A lesson maybe delivered there. I'm glad you were able to stay together despite this difference for 50-plus years, Bill. I don't know. What do you make of that one?
I think that's magical, that two of them managing to stay together despite this profound linguistic difference. Although you often find that in relationships, that different people, because you have different parenting, different experiences, have different attitudes to swearing. There are certain words that I find taboo that my husband didn't, and vice versa. And we've started to kind of respect each other's taboos. But I was wondering what Bill's wife actually thinks if he swears in Russian, because, you know, can she tell by that same intonation, by the fact that it is obviously coming from the place of the same emotion? Does she know he's still swearing? Because he is right. My father-in-law tells this brilliant story. He too was a linguist and was tasked with listening to Russian military radio. And he heard a moment where a pontoon that was meant to be holding various tanks had sunk. And he said that somebody on the radio swore for 4 minutes straight and didn't repeat themselves once. So it's not just the amount, but the variety of swearing in Russian, I'm led to believe, is second to none.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Joe in Wisconsin Dells. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi there. Sort of echoing what the guy said about swearing in Russian, I can swear in six languages,
yes.
Two of which are Klingon and Orcish, but finding it useful in public situations, you can say Feklar, which is the Klingon devil, and nobody really gets offended.
I don't think we have to dump that, no. Yeah. Joe, thanks. He collects that. And yeah, careful using that words around actual Klingons, Joe. Yeah, so that multilingual, and this has got to be a person after your own heart, Emma. He collects swear words.
I think that's terrific. Although, to be fair, from what I understand, it doesn't matter what you say to a Klingon, it's all fighting words. But yeah, that's terrific. And one of the chapters that didn't make it into the book because there wasn't enough science behind it was the fact that so often in science fiction, in speculative fiction, in fantasy, when people make up languages, one of the first things they do is make sure that those languages have a swear word. So there is frack in Battlestar Galactica, or I can't remember what it is that they use in Firefly that's going to bug me now, but here we have something called
Rutten. Rutten is the one in Firefly.
Rutten, yeah. That's it, thank you. And we have Smeg here in Red Dwarf.
In Red Dwarf, yeah.
And why is it that one of the first things that people who make up languages do is that they go, oh yeah, we need a few proper nouns, we need some verbs, we need some regular nouns, and we need swearing. And I think the fact that even chimpanzees swear, even toddlers, as soon as they know that there's a taboo, will start to use words like poo and bum to get an effect. They're absolutely right. If you are making a realistic language, you have to put some swear words in there.
I'll leave it with a quote from your book here, Emma. Swearing is like mustard, a great ingredient, but a lousy meal. Briefly, sprinkle it in. Don't rely on it for our sole means of communication.
Abso-flippin-lutely.
Emma, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's Emma Byrne, science writer and author of Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science of Bad Language. She joined us to talk about swearing, why we do it, and why it sometimes is not so bad for us. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the nominee to lead the CIA testified before the U.S. Senate today. Our guest gives us the details on that Senate hearing and the role of the Central Intelligence Agency. NASA has launched a new probe to do research on Mars. A space journalist tells us what we might learn from the new mission. And we'll look at the nation's favorite novels, and you can call in with your nominations. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.